This is episode 69 of Our Modern Heritage, the Home and Family Culture Podcast. And in this episode, I'm talking with Adrian Alita, and he is an acting teacher at San Diego State University. And he learned by accident that by teaching acting, he was actually teaching emotional intelligence. And there are a lot of awesome best practices in this episode of Adrian teaching me about the power of emotional intelligence through acting, by actually doing the thing that helps you to observe emotions in yourself and other people, to be kinesthetic, you know, have kinesthetic awareness, physical awareness, using questions, using, you know, spatial, you know, understanding, comprehension, and things like that. And so Adrian talked a lot about how his acting experience has enriched his role as husband and father. And he's talked about how to respond when emotions are triggered and there are strong emotions, you know, and how to teach to the whole child. And then he also talked about what we can do to help children recognize their emotions and their strong feelings, how to recognize when children are being reactive or impulsive, and how to shape that behavior. And then he also talked about something called backward design. And that's basically when you come together in a situation, if you're a classroom or a family, and you state what your intention is, what the outcome is that you want to accomplish through that meeting or through the vision that you have for a long-term goal. Great takeaways, great best practices in this episode about emotional intelligence. So I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed talking with Adrian. Adrian Alita and his wife, Hannah, homeschool their 5 children, ages 3 to 12. He is an associate professor of theater and head of acting in San Diego State University and has over 20 years experience performing in various entertainment venues. His versatility in acting is immense, having done everything from being a SEAL trainer and a stuntman to Shakespearean and comedic roles on the stage. As the owner of Act Out in Class, he teaches emotional intelligence through drama workshops and shows teachers and mentors how to effectively do it themselves. You can contact him through Instagram at Act Out in Class or his Facebook page, Act Out in Class. Welcome, Adrian.
Thanks very much for having me.
So glad to have you. So this is so interesting, and I'm really excited to talk about this topic with our audience here, that this idea of teaching the emotional intelligence and how it impacts our family culture. And so, you know, before we started here, we were talking a lot about this and how important this is for our family culture. So can you tell us a little bit more about what emotional intelligence means to you and how you teach, a little bit of how you teach it?
Sure. I mean, first off, it's not something that I was aware that I was doing. Mm-hmm. I fell in love with teaching when I was in graduate school for acting. And as I started teaching, I started getting feedback from students. This class shouldn't be called Acting 1. It should be called Humanity 101. Or I feel that I'm growing not just as an actor, but as a person. Mm-hmm. And then once I encountered the title of emotional intelligence, I realized, oh, that's why students are reacting this way. We're not just talking about vocational skills. That's definitely part of it. Mm-hmm. But in my experience, my opinion, the best actors are the ones that don't just understand the craft, but understand the humanity that causes us to tell stories. And those compelling stories require that actors have an awareness of who they are and how they operate. And then as they're interacting with other actors, that requires that they have an understanding of what's happening in the other person. Mm-hmm. To be able to observe this interaction and to affect it toward their goals. And so all of those things, I mean, that's exactly what is spelled out in emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
So having all of that, I realized that, as weird as it may sound, my graduate school training for actor made me a better father and husband, mm-hmm. which is not at all what I signed up for. Right. But truly digging deeper and deeper into what it is that is happening in each of us individually as human beings and the way that we interact with one another, which is what makes us better actors, has truly affected me as a person and the way I interact with my wife and my children, my students and everyone.
Because you're able to observe what's going on emotionally. And so, because as an actor, you need to be able to see that so that you know because you want to know how you look, right? As an actor, you want to be able to say, this is the character, this is the emotion that I'm portraying. And so it's, you need to have that skill. Yeah.
Well, there are different approaches to the acting. That is one way. This may be a bit tangential, but I have found that for the majority of my students, it's not so much what they can't do. It's more of what's in their way.
Okay.
Most people already have everything they need in order to be a performer. Because when we were kids, we all pretended that the ground was hot lava. Immediately, without hesitation, without reservations, no judgment, we just played.
Yeah.
And a bulk of what I'm doing as an acting teacher is trying to get adults back to that childlike state of play. And that requires that we address the inhibitions. What are the things that are stopping you from doing that? And so the structure of my teaching, my big overall pedagogy, is freedom, passion, technique. If I can address the things that are in your way and get you free, then we can talk about what you're actually passionate about. And if it's acting, great, stay with me. But I love it when students say, you know what, thanks for opening me up. I realize I don't love acting now. I'm going to go do something else. Mwah. It's only after we have a clear knowledge of what your passion is that I actually really get into the technique.
Yeah.
And the technique is more about being aware of what's happening in the other person and dealing with that. So I don't focus so much on, you know, your emotional state or what you're trying to convey to an audience.
Okay.
But more of, okay, what's in front of you and how do you want to deal with that? Which is a life skill.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're absolutely
like good. I was gonna say, it sounds like therapy.
We are very careful to say, I am not a therapist.
Right.
You may find this process therapeutic. But there's certainly some issues that may come up in this class that I'm not qualified to deal with.
Right.
I'm always open to listen. Uh-huh. And if I can't help you, I'm hungry to get you in touch with someone who can.
Right, right. Well, because that would be so inspiring and yet harrowing at the same time when, you know, you might be faced with trying to act in a role that might trigger some really strong feelings.
Yeah.
And go, you know, okay, I notice that you have strong feelings about that. Or do you notice it? Maybe more so, right?
Yes. There are times where I approach students after class and I very quietly, in a small way, say, are you okay?
Yeah.
Send them an email and say, I noticed this. These are my office hours if you would like to chat.
Right.
It's been a little bit overwhelming for me. I didn't expect to have students open up in the way that they have. So for a while, I was known as the teacher who made students cry, which is not me barking at them, but creating an environment, creating a culture that celebrates openness.
Yeah.
Some of my students were never given that in their family situations. And so they're touched that other people would care and support them in that way. And then once it starts opening the floodgates.
That's incredible. But I can see how it could be so helpful to your own family culture. To be able to, you know, if you can establish that kind of a culture in the classroom and how much that helps your students feel like they can open up and feel safe and trust you, you know, just how much that would be so crucial to your own family. And so have you observed that then as you've worked on having that kind of a culture in your home? How has that helped in your family?
So at this point, things are good, but all of our kids are under 12.
Okay.
Yeah. They're 12 and under. And having worked with youth, I know that typically it's, you know, the teenage years where they start pulling away from the parents and seeking other authority figures. So I would say that, yes, we have great relationships with our children, but they haven't quite been tested in the way that I know that they might be coming up in the future. But I will say that I am a words of affirmation person. I love words. And I have found that with our kids, they are open to working with me on my level, that they're willing to talk about things with me because they know, oh, Dad wants to talk. Mm-hmm. So I see the trust there, that there are times where I ask them questions and I know that they don't completely want to express themselves verbally in that moment, but they're willing to, because they know that that's what's needed in that moment for us to strengthen our relationship. Yeah. And I reciprocate. I left a note for my daughter. She went to play out in the snow and I tucked a little note in her glove before she left. There was a time that my son was really angry and he knew he was going to get in trouble because his behavior was unacceptable and he knew it. Mm-hmm. And I could see that he knew it. The body posture, even though he was angry, he had that body posture of the breath, the hunched shoulders, the head down. And so I just walked, and he's a touch. So I just walked over and I held him. Mm-hmm. I didn't say anything. That's me.
Yeah.
He didn't need that in that moment. It was just holding. So in that way, I can see that our culture is working.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a level of vulnerability there that I think that as parents, sometimes I think it's scary, right? To be like, because it takes vulnerability on our side too, to, like you said, like you know, to talk to them, to give them those words or just to hold them, you know, when, especially when their kids feel like they know they're going to be in trouble, but it's almost punishment enough when they know that they're in trouble and they know they've done something wrong.
It took me a long time to learn that.
Yeah.
There are two things that have really been difficult for me to overcome in my growth as a parent. I was spanked as a child and just had more of a don't let kids get away with things.
Right.
And it took me a long time to break free of that, to look at my children and not feel like I had to punish them for wrong deeds and instead and get away and move over toward discipline, teaching, not punishing, teaching. So that moment of hugging my son is an example of that. And then along with that, it took me a long time to be willing to apologize to my kids. Mm-hmm. But I found it's been huge to be able to say to them, hey, you know, just a moment ago when I got angry, that was wrong of me. Mm-hmm. I heard you arguing and I came in and I had no idea what was going on. I just reacted. And what I should have done, and what I've learned, is that I have to model the behavior that I want for them. And that includes acknowledging when I messed up.
Yeah, that reminds me of something you said a little bit ago, is that, you know, when your students come in and they have these strong emotions, you said that you need to hold the space for them to like feel what they're feeling. And I think that to me is a phrase that I think is really crucial to emotional understanding or emotional intelligence, is that when you hold that space and recognize those feelings, then you can know how to be proactive, right? Rather than reactive, you know, you can hold that. When you hold the space, it's like there's that space between what triggered the feeling to what you choose to do with that feeling.
Yes.
So is that basically like what, you know, when you teach this acting or even with your kids, is that basically how you teach them about emotional intelligence?
I think a lot of it is, so in theater, we learn by doing. It's a lot of project-based learning. Mm,
yeah.
So, and because of their age, it's less of imposing curriculum on them, but letting them experience life following their interests and passions, and then being on the side, ready to point things out. Mm-hmm. So some teachers, parents, they hold their knowledge like precious jewels. And then when they feel you've earned it, they dole out the wisdom. And that never sat well with me when I was a student. And so instead I approach it like I'm a tour guide and we're all on the same path. I just happen to be a little bit further along. And as we're walking, I just point out, hey, did you notice that? Did you notice that? So here's an example. We were in Mexico City, and there are vendors everywhere at the temples that we visited. And one by one, I took my older children and I stopped them, and we just had a moment where it was just the two of us. And I said, will you please look at that vendor and tell me what that person is doing? Mm-hmm. And they would say, they're just sitting there. And I asked, how long do you think that they sit there? All day? Yeah, all day. Why? To sell stuff. And then I asked them, is that how you would want to spend your whole day? No, right? And I said, okay, so please look at that person when I tell you this. Your mom and I emphasize education and being willing to work hard so that you have different options. Mm-hmm. People in the United States can still have it hard, but if you have an education and a willingness to work hard, then you have a shot at having a better kind of life. And so in that moment, there is an emotional intelligence component, because they have to observe another person and place themselves in that spot.
Yeah.
Instead of being where you are, imagine being in the shoes of someone else. Mm-hmm. And that informs the education that we're trying to give our children. Hopefully, okay, this is the coolest part of the story. A week and a half later, my son Charlie and I are having our goodnight routine, and he offers a prayer. And I haven't talked about that day in Mexico City since, but in his prayer, he said, thank you that we don't have to sit selling things, hoping that someone will buy it from us. Mm-hmm. And so that was evidence to me that that moment mattered.
Yeah.
Which is so hard for us as parents. There are so many things that we offer our children. We have no idea if they ever take hold.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that I just the other night I was talking to my kids about this, because there's a verse in the scripture of the Book of Mormon that says that preaching the gospel had a more powerful effect on the people than the sword. And then it came to my mind, that phrase, you know, the pen is mightier than the sword. You know? And I think that that's because you impact the heart of others, and it's stronger than any kind of force that you could try to cram down their throats, or, you know, make them live a certain way or do a certain thing. But when you can impact their hearts and the way that they feel and their sense of humanity, then that has a more powerful effect than anything.
Agreed.
It's really a heart education. You know, that's what it comes back to, is like, you want to teach them like how to be human beings. Right. And so that's really powerful. That's awesome. I can see how this would teach the whole child too, you know, that how like powerful it is, because this idea with the force is that you're only going to impact their brain, you know, their mind, or if you just teach to the curriculum, then that's only going to, you know, the definition of academic is not applicable, right? You know, that it's just knowledge based. And so that's, you know, so can you tell us a bit more about that, and how do you teach to the whole child?
I find, so two things, questions and physicality. The point that you just made about not forcing anything, but letting a child discover answers. Yes, we're guiding, mm-hmm. and there's certain answers that, you know, we're leading them toward. But when we teach through questions, the implication there is that we value the thought process. We value what is being offered from the child. So as opposed to just straight lecturing, I really love utilizing questions. And then it also, you know, sometimes you can be surprised. You throw out a question, you think that's going to lead to a discussion, but the child just nails it. Uh-huh. Didn't know what they knew. And the question highlights that for you. But then the other thing is physicality. One day on lunch, we ran down to Balboa Park. My wife met me at work with all the kids. We ran to Balboa Park for lunch. And there's a picture. I had grabbed two of my kids and I was just swinging them around, and they're giggling. And it was just a really beautiful moment. And I looked at that picture and I titled it Trust. Just the idea of teaching physics and trust at the same time, because they're swinging through the air, but enjoying it. They're not terrified of it. And that, I love the use of roughhousing to build a family culture, that it's developing this kinesthetic awareness, but it's also building a trust that, hey, we can really use our bodies touching one another with force, and I'm going to protect you. Mm-hmm. I'm going to keep you safe. And I feel like that for me has grown outward in so many other places. And I've made a lot of mistakes with this and continue to do so. But when I'm at my best, I'm telling my children, no matter what's going on with you, I'm going to hold the space. I'm going to keep you safe.
Yeah.
And we will work through it. I'm not going to, and which is not the same thing as saying, I let my children do whatever they want. Mm-mm. They can have everything they want. They're never getting in trouble for anything. It's not that.
Yeah.
It's knowing that when they have messed up, I am aware enough to acknowledge their feelings about it, that I'm going to help protect them from self-loathing. I'm going to protect them from being shamed.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep them safe so that they can get to the other side of whatever it is that they're dealing with.
That's inspiring, because I think that when, you know, I have one son that's really, he's super impulsive. He's really emotional. He hates being told no.
That is my son. How old is your son?
He's 8.
Ours is 10. Very
similar. Well, it's so hard, but this idea of helping them get through that feeling, a lot of times my impulse and my reaction is, would you just cut it out? Or, you know, I just want to be like, listen, I know that that's really hard to accept this no answer from me right now, but you need to just figure it out. But this idea of teaching them to work through the problem and hold this space, that's inspiring, because I need to practice that more with him, because, you know, a lot of times I forget. And so, but that idea of helping him hold that space, recognizing what he's feeling to get through it, because a lot of times he just gets angry and runs away and I'm like, okay, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
But I like that holding the space for him and what helping him work through as a guide, as a mentor, going, I see you have these strong feelings. Let's work them through together.
I have three tips about it. Just realized.
I'm ready.
So the first was, with all of them, when they're young, I teach them to breathe.
Mm.
And I have them practice with me. So I say, look at dad, breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth. And we don't do it only in those high emotion moments. You know, we practice it outside of that. So that when we do come to a high emotion moment, it's not new.
Yeah.
But there are times where I can look at them if they've been hurt or they're angry about something or they're sitting there crying, to work them through it. Be with daddy, breathe. And that doesn't always help, but sometimes it does. And it's really great.
That's perfect. Yeah.
Another one is asking them in that moment, do you know why you were told no? Because what's really great is there are times where I feel like, oh, I've got to take care of this thing. But I'll ask, do you know why you were told no? And immediately I'll see a shift. They'll go, yes, great. And that in that moment, I'm done. Mm. Because they've acknowledged. So I don't need to preach anything.
Yeah.
And also in that moment, in their brains and in their hearts, in order to be able to answer that question, a shift happens. And the anger is already beginning to, so I just leave it alone.
Yeah. It goes from being an argument of you trying to sell them on no and them trying to convince you why you should say yes, to you already understand.
Right.
The end.
And you know, there's a lot of work you have to do before you can get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have your family councils. You have to have an open discussion about how your family works and why, so that the children is not blindsided by the no.
Yeah.
But they need to have an understanding when the no's are going to be coming.
Uh-huh.
But then there's another trick that, so from 5 years of working with sea lions at SeaWorld, you have to have variety. If you are overly predictable, it becomes difficult to train an animal. And so I feel like this is going to sound so silly, but there are times when my kids will ask for something and I'll say no. And then if they handle that no well, I'll say, you accepted that no so well, you can have the thing that you asked for.
Wow.
Dad, can we have some ice cream? I don't think we need to have ice cream tonight. So the answer is no. Okay. Thank you so much for accepting my no response. Why don't we all have a little bit of ice cream? And so we're reinforcing the desired behavior. They accepted the no. So yeah, have ice cream.
So that's interesting that you bring up your experience with the sea lions. And so how did that lead you? How did that lead you into acting now? And how does, or maybe more importantly, how does that feed into your experience of teaching emotional intelligence in your acting courses?
Certainly. I was performing at SeaWorld in front of 2,500 seat audiences, and I really loved it, and it could have been a career. So when I discovered that SeaWorld offered an 85% tuition reimbursement, I thought, okay, I'll go get a college degree, and why not do theater? That would be fun. I don't need it to be a job. So that's how that happened. Uh-huh. And I feel as though everyone would benefit if they tried training an animal for a while, because you don't get that verbal communication. Mm-hmm. You are forced to watch the animal and understand what's going on with them just based on their physicality.
Oh, yeah.
So the size of their eyes, the intensity and frequency of their breathing, whether they're flat on their bellies or they've tucked their flippers under and are up, ready to go. All of that stuff is useful when we're dealing with one another as humans. If you and I are having a conversation, the distance between our bodies, if your body is leaning toward me or away, if you have your arms folded, all of these things are cues as to the nature of our relationship, our interaction in that moment.
Right.
Some of us haven't been trained to observe them and to process that information.
Well, and that goes back to, teaching the whole child. And you said that wrestling, how that teaches their, what did you say, their spatial?
The kinetic awareness. Or kinesthetic awareness.
Well, I think that's something that a lot of kids who sit in the classroom all day long are really missing out. And, you understood it and you learned it from teaching an animal. And maybe if there's no other option, your kids have to spend all day in school, then maybe getting a pet that they can learn that skill, that they can train, like a dog or something, that they could train or something like that. That would be a powerful resource to teaching that, because ultimately the goal would be let them get outside, let them use their body, wrestle with them, do those physical things. But a lot, because kids' lives are so limited, then what is the solution? It looked like you had something you wanted to say.
Well, I was just, I just lit up because I saw that you were starting to talk about homeschooling versus traditional public education. And no matter what it is that your family is working with, you have to know that you cannot trust that everything you want your children to receive is going to be given them by someone outside of your home. Mm-hmm. If they're at public school, there are still things that if you are a member of any church, you can't expect that the values that you celebrate in your faith are going to be taught at public school. And so you still have work to do with your children after that. So as a homeschooler, yes, we do have a dog, and I trained our children on how to train him. Uh-huh. So all of them know when you feed Jackson, he has to sit and look you in the eyes before you put the food down. Mm-hmm. And so it was just so cool seeing these really little children with a bowl almost bigger than they are. Say, Jackson, sit. Eyes. And waiting until he looked them in the eyes before they gave him his food.
Wow.
And so, that right there, that is the beginning of teaching emotional intelligence using this interaction with a pet. Another thing I wanted to say when you're talking about the whole child and the physicality, one of the games that we play using theater to teach emotional intelligence is we will have all the children take a really empty phrase like, I like pens. And I'll say, okay, if you were really, really angry, how would you stand? And they strike a pose and I say, how do those words come out of you if you're really angry? I like pens. And we go through anger and happiness and sadness. And so, first of all, they're in a big group of people all expressing emotional states, even though it's fake. But what we're doing is we're saying it's okay to express emotions around other people. Uh-huh. We're also allowing them to observe how emotions manifest differently in different people. Uh-huh. But then the cool game that we play is I put someone up on stage and I say, okay, I want you to let your body take a shape based on an emotion and you get to choose. And so let's say that they're up there and they're really sad. And I say, okay, the game is somebody has to go up and say something to that person that's wrong, that doesn't make sense. How would you not approach someone if they were like that? Mm-hmm. So the person on stage is really, really sad. And then the other person jumps up and says, hey, it's my birthday today. Do you want to have cake? Which you wouldn't, if someone's sad, you would address their being sad.
Yeah.
And so the person gets up and does that and everyone in the class laughs and we get to say, okay, why are you laughing? What is wrong about this interaction? And so it's a theater game.
Right.
But really it's a life skill. How are you able to determine what's going on with somebody else? And what are some of the appropriate ways that you would interact with someone if that's what their emotional state was?
Wow. That would be, powerful to learn that, to know how to react to people. That's cool.
Yeah.
I want to go on to talk about this. I touched a little bit about my son and his impulse control. How do you teach about impulse control? And so it sounds like even that game could be, how to interact with others and how to, respond to those physical, when people look a certain way or emoting a certain way. So how do you talk about impulse control?
In terms of the theater games, one of the really great things that you can do is have a ritual to start class. We have rituals in our lives all over the place, opening prayer, closing prayer, as examples. And the one that I really like for theater is that we all stand in a circle, mm-hmm. and you don't enter the circle until you're ready. So if you need to fidget, adjust your clothes, bop your knees, do that. And then when you step into the circle, it's gone. Mm-hmm. And so we have this circle of all these young children just standing there, breathing, being present to one another without any fidgeting, without any outbursts. They're just present. And so using that as part of the theater world helps train them to just release impulses, not follow them, and breathe and be present. To go along with that, we then have games that are specifically about following impulse. So what we're doing is we're creating a separation between the two. And so the children can, in their bodies, in their breaths, and in their minds, experience them as being separate and learn to recognize one from the other. So if I have a game where they're just supposed to jump in the circle and shout out their name, and then after they shout out their name, just say whatever is the first word that pops in their head. That's an impulse game. Or another one where I clap my hands, and every time I clap my hands, they make a shape. So now we're moving from brain to body. Uh-huh. And I just continue clapping my hands, and boom, boom, they're moving their bodies in all these impulsive ways. So I'm giving them a positive outlet for impulses, mm-hmm. and counterbalancing it with moments where, okay, let's let all of that go. So then in my family life, because my kids have played these kinds of games, when they're in a high emotion moment, I can just take a step back and ask them, can you breathe right now? Can you let that go? Can you let you're in a moment where you're following impulse. Can you let that go? And because they're familiar with what that is, the differences between the two, then not always, but sometimes, yeah, they're able to recognize I'm out of control. I know what that feels like. I also know what it feels like to let that go. I've experienced that. So we're just, you know, like any other skill, it's a succession of approximations. It's baby steps. By small and simple things are great things brought to pass. But this is all backward design. Is your family culture, you have to decide what it is that you want for your children. Mm-hmm. You have to know what that looks like and then say, okay, if this is the end result, what are the steps to get them there? Break it down to these different components and let's start training them now.
Yeah.
Build up to that. And you have to be ready to forgive them for falling short. It's another huge mistake that I've made so many times. Expecting the 6-year-old to act like the 10-year-old because I've grown accustomed to the 10-year-old.
Right.
I forgot what the 10-year-old was like when they were six. So right. You know, in addition to everything that we're doing as parents to train our children, we're constantly retraining ourselves.
Mm, totally.
We have to put as much, if not more, energy into making sure where we need to be so that we can help get them to where we want them to be.
Well, you brought up earlier that we have to model, you know, everything we model for our kids is exactly the behavior that they, and also, you know, I've observed too, because I have stress like everyone else, but when I'm particularly stressful, even if I'm not interacting with my kids while I'm stressed, they start acting out.
Yeah. You know?
And it's like, man, why are they making this even worse? And so that's when I need to be able to step back, calm myself down, you know, get my impulses under control and like be with them to try and reassure them that they're safe, that we're okay, you know, and to not, you know, just bring it back down and then model that behavior for them that I would want them to see or to do is that, you know, when I'm stressed out, I would model how to do this, how to hold space, how to, you know, to not be impulsive and then demonstrate that to them so that I can be their guide to be able to show them how to do that.
Yeah.
So you brought up backward design and that sounds a lot like family culture. Family culture is like finding, you know, figure out what your vision is of what you want, you know, the outcome of your family culture to be in the future. And then coming back to today and saying, what can I do? Can you tell us some more about that? What does it mean to you to the backward design?
For me, that came from animal training. If you want a sea lion to wave at an audience, you have to know what that looks like and then break it down and say, okay, what are the building blocks? What are the different steps to get to that? Because of that experience, I've always taught theater the same way. And this is now somewhat of a small revolution in universities and in academia that so there are seminars now about teaching teachers how to do this. Mm-hmm. Instead of taking everything you know and then just throwing it at students, you should actually sit down and say, what is it that I want the students to know to be able to do by the end of the semester? Mm. What from my repertoire actually serves that? And so that's this backward design.
So it sounds kind of like having like a mission statement, kind of. You know, that it's like, you know, what the outcome you want to see and how to actually accomplish it.
That's the word, the outcome. So in my world at the university, they're called student learning outcomes. Okay. By the end of the semester, the student will be able to fill in the blank. By the end of the semester, the student will be able to identify emotions in other people. Huh. By the end of the semester, the student will be able to express themselves both physically and vocally, either by following impulse or by responding to a memorized body of text. And so if you sit down with your family and you say, okay, with our children, they will like fill in the blank. What is it that you want your children to be able to do? And the Boy Scouts that work this way, any organization that has run well is working this way. You have a vision for what it is, where you're trying to get them to. And then you break it down to figure out what needs to happen to get there. So years ago, we had a friend over and she was preparing a homeschooling, what do you call, my words are fan. Yeah, so like an intro.
Summit or?
Oh. Yeah. And so she's gathering information and her thoughts. And she said, Adrian, what's the most important thing you want to teach your children? That they're worthy of being loved. That was the first thing that came to my mind. And ever since then, that has been, I have to be really careful here because I don't want to feel like a fraud. Like I say these things and they're up here and I know we don't always live what we know. So,
right.
This is just an exclusive little bit of me talking about the thing and it's all the most noble, positive things, but truly I'm messing up all the time. But when I'm at my best, I can very clearly connect my behavior with that mission statement. I want my children to know that they are worthy of being loved. If they have that, they will be able to work through feelings of guilt without it leading to shame. Mm-hmm. They will be open to repentance as opposed to self-loathing. Mm-hmm. If they are going to have faith in a savior and believe that they're worthy of a loving heavenly father who has gifted them with a plan of salvation, it stems from them believing that they're worthy of being loved. And from my personal experience and experience working with youth in our ward, I know that that's a huge obstacle.
Yeah.
I've heard people talk about having faith, knowing that there's a heavenly family, knowing that there's a plan of salvation, but struggling to believe that it applies to them. Mm-hmm. Because how could he forgive me? How could he love me?
Right.
And so I believe that the best things that await my children as they grow will only be fully accepted by my children if they have a belief that they're worthy of being loved. Well, an idea that was shared with me, I was at a seminar and the leader shared how his kids are not his kids.
Right.
He is merely their shepherd. And that had a huge impact on me. And that's where the idea of holding the space came from, that none of my children, no one on this earth was put here to be what you need them to be. And so my job with the children is not to raise them in a way that satisfies me,
right,
but to hold the space and give them the skills so that they can carve out the life that will be satisfying to them. And there's a great book that I use. It's called The Inner Game of Tennis. Might sound like an odd title to use in a movement for actors class, but it's really wonderful. It talks about the different functions of the brain, that there's the part of your brain that has a really strong connection to your body that can watch somebody do something and then just do it. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of your brain that's like, well, wait a minute, are you sure you know how to do it? And that conflict that exists between us. It's a really great book for acting teachers, but it's a really great book for people, parents, I think specifically, because there's one section that talks about how the seed for a rose bush already contains everything that it needs to become a beautiful rose. And at no point do we ever chastise the seed, the stem, the bud for not yet being the beautiful rose.
Right.
How often do we do that to our own children?
Or ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are two things that have really, again, when I'm at my best, influence me to see my children as they are, to understand my role. And one thing I love about being a member of the church and also teaching arts is the parallel that we draw. Christ said, come follow me. He didn't say, okay, get your act together, go work through your problems, go find forgiveness, and then come follow me. It's no, come follow me right now. Mm-hmm. Exactly as you are. And I'm going to walk with you. And I feel like in art, that's the same thing that we're saying. Give me what you got right now. You don't feel like you have to get things perfect. I want you to offer. I want you to be open right now. Give us what you got and we'll work with it. There's a great clip from Ira Glass on creativity. And he talks about how in the beginning, your stuff is not good and you know it. And the reason why you know it is because you have great taste. That's why you're doing the thing. Uh-huh. And he says, the only way to get through that is to just do a lot of work. And I think it's so wonderfully appropriate to life that wherever it is in life that we feel like we're struggling, we just have to put effort into it. We have to do more. That's the first and most important step. Because if we quit, we don't know how we're going to get to where we're going to get. But I can guarantee you that if you just stop, I know that you're never going to get to where you want to get. So the last thing that you were also talking about, I think is really important. When I was called to serve with the youth, I knew that it wasn't my job to control their behavior. And I knew it wasn't my responsibility to make sure that they never messed up. My hope was that we were building strong enough bonds and planting enough seeds that when they did find themselves deviating from a path, that time would be shortened. Here's the analogy. This is the visual that struck me. Is we have these hardships in life, whether because of outside influences or from mistakes that we've chosen, and they hit us like a boulder. And the impact when we catch that boulder is so powerful that it breaks the bones in our arms. And every time we try to let go of that boulder, the pain from our broken arms is so intense that we just, oh, no, I'm just going to hold it. Yes, I'm in pain, but letting it go hurts more. So I'm just going to sit here. And I feel like that's how life growth really is, that in order to move forward, you have to experience even more pain in letting go of that boulder. But if you don't, then you're always just going to sit in that pain. You're never going to heal.
Yeah.
And having that understanding, I've done this with youth, and I'm grateful for the experience because I know at some point I may have to do it with our children. I've identified that they were in pain because of a mistake, because they were not where they wanted to be. And I just knew I was ready to help them experience even more pain, because that's what it takes as you travel back. I know there are people out there who either have faith and are not members, or they are members and have fallen away and have a desire to come back. And the reason why they don't, why they're not moving forward, is because they know what it's going to take to travel the distance between where they are and where they want to be. They know how hard it's going to hurt, and they're just not ready to drop that boulder. And if we on the outside of them know that that's the process, we have a better understanding of how to support them.
Yeah, that it takes that grace. And even if it's just whatever changes you know you need to make in your life. Like a lot of times when I address, you know, my audience about family culture and how a lot of times it takes letting go of customs that you grew up with and that are unhealthy, you know.
Yeah.
That's a harrowing experience sometimes. And, you know, and it's about coming together as a family to decide, you know, what does work, and then go through the process of that change. But that change is not always easy.
No, I'm always cautious when I talk about this. I don't feel like I could ever say I'm grateful for the individual trials that I've experienced. You know, it just feels so odd to say, yes, I'm grateful that loved one passed away early.
Right.
But wow. I am grateful for a Heavenly Father wise enough to allow for these trials and challenges. Hmm. Because, you know, when talking with the youth, you say, why do we have these hardships? And I say, so Heavenly Father will know, you know, will really know what you're willing to do or what you can do. I say, well, doesn't Heavenly Father already know everything? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, you're right. So the hardships are so that you know what you're capable of.
Yeah.
Not think, believe, project, but you actually know. And I love what you're talking about in terms of family culture. We're, you know, we have our ups and downs with it. There are times where, like, wow, yeah, we've really been on it with family council. This feels great. Uh-huh. Everybody's in. It's not just parents deciding for children. It's our family coming together and deciding as a group what's important. And then other times we realize, wow, it's been months where we're just surviving.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember what it feels like to thrive. We got to figure something's wrong. What do we got to do here? But it's the kind of, I don't remember having those kinds of conversations when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. So I love that this kind of thing is out there. I'm big into communication. The 1 Minute Manager was a book that we were required to read as animal trainers. Mm-hmm. And it's had a profound effect on me in my life.
Another one that's similar to that is The Hands-Off Manager. That one, they talk a lot. He talks a lot about this idea of holding space, because as a manager and a leader, it's not top down. It's actually lifting others up. And so it was so inspiring the way that he talks about how things are created and that you have to have a vision first and create things spiritually before they can be created physically it was a really inspiring book. So awesome, Adrian, this has been so amazing. I think I could talk to you for like hours and hours. But this has really been, I think one of the most inspiring discussions that I've had about family culture, because so much of this comes back to, if we can be so self-aware that we know how to lead our families or how to address our feelings, then that's what leads to a place of safety and forward movement for our families. Mm. That's really inspiring. And I think that really, everything you said, everything we talked about really has like almost put into a nutshell everything that I'm trying to accomplish with my thought, with this platform, that I really want to support families to be more aware of what they want as a family and how to get there. And that it requires grace and it requires an awareness of how to deal with the struggles along the way, because it's not, there are the struggles. It's just one struggle after another, and how to deal with those struggles and not just bowl your kids over or bowl the situation over and just go, well, let's just push through it or whatever, but to intentionally shape it to what, what you hope for the outcome to be.
Yes. I know oftentimes when we deal with hardships, the phrase God's will gets thrown out a lot. Mm-hmm. And for where we're at, how can we begin to imagine truly understanding God's will? But one thing that I've learned through my experiences is that at least part of God's will is for us to be here on this earth and experience adversity and figure out how to get through it.
Yeah.
Because as you said, we all have struggles. And if we're here by design, then those struggles must be part of the design as well, or else he wouldn't allow for them to exist. And so part of our growth, and I don't want to exclude anyone who doesn't share the faith that we do, but for those that do, and it seems clear to me that everything that we know through the scriptures and modern revelation is teaching us that this is a necessary skill, mm-hmm. that it truly is designed as part of our plan of salvation.
Another really good book is Outwitting the Devil by Napoleon Hill. And he goes into that a lot, where every failure is the seed of equal or greater opportunity.
Oh.
And if you think about, all the stories that you hear of people who accomplish really amazing things, they had to go through really trying experiences. I mean, that our mutual friend, Kathy Miller, and I talked about this in the episode with her. She talked about the hero's journey, and that you have to be, you get inspired, you get called up to get out of your comfort zone, and you go through a harrowing experience, but then you come through it victorious and you come through it better. And so it's like, that's what life is all about. It's our own individual hero's journey.
Yes, the hero's journey and the plan of salvation are parallel.
Exactly. And it's just, all these different stories of people who go through these things and you go, I can never accomplish that. I can never do that. But you just have to be willing to answer the call to get up and do.
Yeah. One thing that we talked about in class, a student the other day said, I can't do this. And I stopped everything and I just shared with them, I know that we sometimes say, I can't, but if we dig deeper, usually what that means is I can't yet do this thing at a level that satisfies my own judgment. Mm. Once we recognize that that's the thing, then we say, okay, well, let me just give what I've got right now, knowing that it's not what it will eventually be. Let me be willing. If you want to be great at anything, you have to be willing to be horrible at it for a while in the beginning.
Thank you so much, Adrian. This is great. And in conclusion, if you don't mind asking this or answering this question, I like to ask, what does it mean to you to, what does the word legacy mean to you?
As you pose the question, I realize one of the reasons why we struggle sometimes between thriving and surviving is because we're not thinking about legacy. We're not thinking about what impact do I want my time to have on the people after. So as I think about it, one of the reasons why I am a teacher is I love being, it's such a humbling experience to be in the presence of someone when they awake intellectually or emotionally. And I think that my big picture dream is that after having shared those kinds of experiences with other people, they'll be hungry to share it with others.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on my show, Adrian. It was such a delight.
I loved chatting with you.
So Adrian wanted me to add something about his answer about what legacy represents to him. And he said that one day on break, an acting student handed him a small piece of paper which read, "Who you are is enough." And he said, what is this? And the student said, "That's what you teach." And Adrian's response was, "I've never once said this in class." And the student said, "That's what you teach." And so that's what legacy represents to Adrian, is that he wanted to say that who you are is enough. And that's the legacy that he wants to leave for his students, for his children, that who you are is enough. And so I just love that. I'm so grateful that I was able to have Adrian on the show and talk about these things, such a powerful message. And you can go find Adrian at Act Out in Class on Instagram and Facebook and YouTube, and just learn from this opportunity to share with our families what it takes to understand emotional intelligence through this spatial understanding, through emotional comprehension and kinesthetic awareness and all these things. So thank you so much. You can go check out my show notes at homeandfamilyculture.com and follow me on Instagram at Family Culture Podcast. Mother Teresa once said, "If you want to change the world, go home and love your family."